Welcome back, guys. DGS on KMOX. Happy Friday. Happy Juneteenth. Happy Father's Day for all you fathers out there. The Cardinal Report is sponsored by Rawlings. Visit the Rawlings experience at Westport. I just went this week, and I loved it, loved it. We welcome back to the show a great friend of the show. He's kind of the fifth Beatle. Cardinals pitcher Scott Terry. Scott, always great to talk to you, my friend.
Yes, sir. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
You are welcome. Man, what do you want to talk about? Like, we do this so much, and like, hey, Bernie this, and hey, Matt Pauly that, and I never just let people go. Like, what's on your Cardinal mind?
Oh, man, what a tough... See, now you're going to put it in my head? That's the last place to go. I'll tell you. No, I tell you what, I've been very excited about these guys, the way they're playing, the way they go about their business. But I'll give you a little insight. I do the Cardinal Kids Clinics. Uh-huh. So I have gotten to meet J.J. Weatherholt. I've
nice.
Gotten to meet Jordan Walker. I've gotten to meet Michael McGreevy. And these guys are coming out to our Cardinals Kids Clinics, and they are talking to the kids ages 6 to 13, and they're doing an awesome job, and they're giving up their time when they're here in town. And we had Jordan Walker out Bridgeton along with Michael McGreevy, and the kids obviously just love them.
That's just great.
But these guys are doing awesome. So they're giving back in ways that a lot of people don't know and understand, and they're giving up their time, even in the thick of the season, for the kids. So they've been great. So I really appreciate them.
Scott, we talked about this a little bit when you joined us out at Patio's, but I thought it was so interesting. My son was listening. He said it was so great. I want to delve into it a little more. This team, to me, has so many great aspects. They're young, they're fun, they're feisty, they don't give up, and yet they have a real sense of being pros. Can you talk a little bit more about what that means as a big leaguer to be a pro?
It's just the way you go about your business. It's about having each other's back. You know, these guys truly, truly like each other. They have a locker room that is really working in unison. If they have a clunker like they had last night, they're going to come back today as if that clunker didn't happen. It's a new day, turn the page, and they're going to go about their business the same way. Talked to Jordan Walker at the kids' clinic the other day. He gets to the ballpark at 1 o'clock in mm-hmm. the afternoon for a 6:45 game. Now, just think about that. Back in the day when I played, we got there at 4. We didn't have a kitchen. We didn't have a video room. We didn't have a weight room. We didn't have a nutritionist. We didn't have a strength coordinator. We didn't have somebody setting up a game plan. But those are all the details that they get to check all those boxes. And they're taking the time on a daily basis to do that and to take care of their own business, which means I care about the guy next to me.
It's fascinating, too, Scott, because you guys all had your routines. But when you're talking about managing an extra 4 hours a day, I think the routine might be more important now than it's been, really. I think for all athletes, because now it's about your sleep, right? It's about everything. It's your food. It's your diet. It's exercise. It's lifting. It's recovering. And sleep's a big part of that. That routine just has to be critical.
And that routine, Kevin, is what's getting them to the point that they're at. So much better at a younger age, so much more fit, so much more on top of everything and every aspect of the game that we didn't do because we really didn't have the opportunity, number one. But number two, the facilities, the people,
right.
All the other people putting in the extra time with each one of these guys individually. And if they're taking care of their business and they're preparing themselves and each one of them is doing that, then you can see why there's a better chance of success.
I think that it also can be, Scott, and every guy's different, but it can also be part of what goes wrong with a player. If, you know, it may not be talent, it may not be, something real simple. It can be that your routine's out of whack and you need to make some adjustments in how you're going about that business, whether it's a pitcher taking care of his body or a hitter working on his swing.
Yeah, and then sometimes we can actually do too much.
Right.
So that
right.
you become paralyzed as a result of your preparation.
It's that was like, Jordan
oh, no,
Walker,
I didn't
right?
get to, Yeah. Oh, no, I didn't get to do this, you know. Right. And so since I didn't do that, I'm not prepared, and I'm not going to. And if I'm doing all that and going through all that mentally in my head before I even play the game, then it can go the other way. So hopefully they're getting the right mix. They appear to be.
Yeah.
They appear to be. Everybody that has come up has contributed, and they have gone about their business and has fit in. So I really like, you know, like what you see, like what you hear from the guys as well as from management and, of course, from Heim Bloom.
So Libby, of course, has been struggling as of late. I'm sure it's different when a pitcher struggles and when a shortstop struggles. And not that you haven't experienced this at this, but if you could talk a little bit about that special frustration as a pitcher when things just aren't happening the way they're supposed to happen.
It is not easy to deal with, but you just got to trust yourself at some point in time and just keep pushing through it. You know, we used to always say that everything equals out. And then when you look back at it over a period of time, you say, well, no, it doesn't. So, he's having some struggles. It could be pitch location. It could be pitch selection. It could be a number of different things just are not clicking for him. But more often than not, it's just you're not doing as well as you want to do. And it's not because you're not putting in the time and the effort. You're just not getting it done. You know, I'm not making my pitch when I need to make my pitch, or I'm not hitting the location I need to hit, or I'm not putting myself in a position. Pitching is so much different today than it used to be. I would go through the first part of a lineup. I would go through the with just two pitches, a sinker and a change, or maybe a sinker and a slider. And nowadays they got six pitches and they're going to throw all six pitches and show all six pitches. And me, you know, if I was Libby, if I was talking to Libby, and of course I'm not, but I would say, let's get it simple. Let's get it back to keeping it simple. Let's make sure we can master three pitches. Cause I think if you can throw three pitches in any count versus having six pitches that you have to use and try to distribute, I think you simplify things for yourself, and that's the way to get out of a slump.
It's an interesting thing, Scott, because I was thinking about this. I was talking about it with Matt Pauly the other day. I can't remember if it was on or off the air, but it's such a common thing now because pitchers can go to a lab and they can see all the characteristics of pitches. They're like Paul Skeens has six pitches. You know, the best guys in the game keep adding pitches, but as you kind of point out, Paul Skeens doesn't need six pitches. Like, he'd be fine with three, and some guys can't handle five or six. And I'm not speaking specifically of Libby here. I'm just talking generally in Major League Baseball. Sometimes more isn't better.
I would agree. It's hard enough to master one pitch. Now you want to try to master six. You know, when I watch Libby, and he is at a disadvantage in reference to when he starts, he's going to get a lot of right-handers in. So nothing's right. Going away. He does not have a pitch that he can move away from a right-hander. I can throw a two-seam fastball or a four-seam fastball away from them, but I still don't have the movement that I have on the other pitches. If his velocity is down, then he has a tendency to be hit harder because if they sit on the velocity and the velocity is less than what it normally is, they can catch up to it or he can't throw it past them. So I don't know what his repertoire is. I don't know what his pitch selection is all the time because I don't get to see every time he pitches.
Right.
But I know for me, keep it simple. And the one thing I would do is I would throw a lot more changeups.
Yeah,
I throw a changeup as left on right, and I got a fastball and two fastballs and a slider. That one changeup has the same rotation as my fastball, but the hitter's going to have a hard time seeing speed and doesn't have as much time to see speed, and it makes my fastball better.
When you were teaching pitching, Scott, on a day-to-day basis and working, especially with your more advanced students, right, the high school kids or the kids that were either college or going into college, how much was your focus on pitch execution versus pitch selection, like in a given count or given, you know, facing a certain type of hitter or whatever?
Yeah, pitch selection and pitch execution are really completely different things because mm-hmm. for me to execute my pitches, what I'm going to focus on is just repeating my motion.
Right.
If I can repeat my motion and the tempo of my motion, the timing of my motion, then I should be able to command all the pitches that I throw because they're coming out of the same motion. Now, that pitch selection, I wonder in today's day and age with all the game planning that they do with the catchers. You know, who's calling the pitch? Am I comfortable with the pitch that I'm throwing? Am I just nodding my head and throwing what they asked me to throw without a thought, without my own input within that game selection? So sometimes if the pitcher's half-hearted involved into the pitch that he's throwing, he's not going to throw the best pitch that he can. So that pitch selection, I don't know who's making it. I don't know who all goes into coming up with that, because they have so many numbers now where they say this guy is vulnerable to this pitch, or this guy, we need to want to throw this in this count. For me, it always popped in my head right after I threw a pitch, or I would actually throw a pitch knowing what I'm going to come back and throw the next pitch. So I was really into that part 100% with my focus, with my concentration, with the knowledge that I had against the hitter that I've got and the stuff that I have. Scott, I don't know if they have that much going into every selection.
Scott, what percentage of the time, you personally, and you know, if you know from other guys, if there's an average, what percentage of the time when you took the mound after the first few pitches did you go, I got it, this is a good day for Scott?
Oh, probably about 1 out of 8.
Oh,
yeah, it's tough.
Interesting.
It's tough. It's really tough to go out there every time feeling great, feeling like you're in total command of what you're doing. And I think it's easier for a starter to get that than it is for a reliever, because a reliever pitches much more often and pitches to situations much more than a starter does, because a starter can go out and start the inning and dictate more or less, you know, and then make his adjustments as he goes. But, oh, man, very seldom do I feel like, oh, man, today is my day. And sometimes those would be the days when you got your butt kicked.
That's pretty
like,
great.
Whoop, I guess I wasn't so good.
Yeah. Well, and you speak to it, Scott, too, about how much, at least from the outside perception, you being a pitcher would know it better than I would be as a person that didn't pitch. But the idea of trying to fix things when you're a reliever as opposed to a starter who's got 4 days in between, bullpen days to schedule, you can even do a little bit of light stuff on a regular throw day, where bullpen guys, most of the time, they need you to be available.
Yes, and of course, back when I pitched, we only had 4 or 5 guys out there.
Right, right.
But Mike Rourke was our pitching coach back in those days, and I had another good pitching coach with Joe Torre by the name of Joe Coleman.
Mm-hmm.
What we would do a little 3-minute, 5-minute session, a side session during the day, you know, when we would get to the ballpark. And so we knew that even if we did 3 to 5 minute session through 10, 12 pitches, that we weren't going to be available that night. So you just had to be judicious with that.
Right.
And Mike Rourke never wanted us off the mound more than 2 days in a row. And that was any mound.
All right.
So if we didn't pitch one day and we didn't do any bullpen work or any mound work one day and didn't pitch that night, and now we come to the next day and we don't work at all off a mound that day, then for sure the next day we're going to get some mound work prior to the game, whether even though we're still available to pitch.
Scott, what
so
was
it's a matter of being on that slope? I know nowadays they do a lot of flat ground work.
Yeah, yeah,
and that's. You know, that's a little different than doing mound work. But when we were going to work on pitches or do things, we usually always did it on the mound.
Scott, what were your favorite stadium to pitch and your least favorite stadium to pitch?
I loved pitching in Shea Stadium. And the reason I love pitching in Shea Stadium is because they had a Cadillac mound. And I call it a Cadillac mound because they had Dwight Gooden, because they had Frank Viola, because they had David Cone.
They took care of
them. They had all these pitchers, and they were all top-notch pitchers, so that mound was immaculate.
Hmm.
I mean, it wasn't like going to my house. It was like you guys were talking earlier, it was like going to the penthouse. And so, you know, back in the day, they didn't always regulate or keep track of everybody's mound. You know, as much as they do today, where everything is just really done, where everybody is exactly the same.
Right.
But, boy, I tell you, when you went to Shea Stadium and you got on that mound, you knew that, oh, man, this is going to be nice. It's like walking into your house with brand-new carpet.
That's cool.
It's the good stuff.
Yeah, I mean the good stuff. But and then vice versa, when we would go to Philly, because Philly wasn't very good in those days, I want to say their number one starter was Shane Raleigh.
Oh, yeah.
So they were a little bit void in reference to their pitching staff. They tried to outslug you. When you would go to that mound, it was like pitching on the street.
Well, Veterans Stadium was kind of that way anyway, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, and there was a lot of people throwing stuff at you. Their mound was much more flat. It was so much harder to pitch. But for me, it made it easier for me to pitch because it made my sinker sink more.
Okay.
But, yeah, you go from different places, different mounds, and that's what always made it better for me. But also just the atmosphere at Shea Stadium. Back when we played the Mets, of course, they were pond scum.
Yeah,
it's a good term that everybody knows about if you remember the rivalry and the people that you were facing. I mean, I was just always fired up to get the pitch at Shea Stadium.
That's great. Scott, it's always great to talk to you. Have a great weekend, my friend.
Hey, thanks. You too. Happy Father's Day.
Man, I've never made a single mixtape in my life because I was invisible to girls.
You didn't make it for yourself?
No.
Really?
No. I did
all the time for car rides, whatever.
Yeah, I didn't have like the
I get you.
Skill.
Patience. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't have any of that
you
stuff.
You didn't have a dual cassette tape player?
I didn't
player.
Have that. No, I definitely didn't have that. And if I would have, I wouldn't have known how to work it. So, did you make mixtapes?
Yeah, but I would burn CDs.
I was going to say, they probably weren't tapes.
Yeah. Showed our age.
Yeah, those CDs were expensive, too.
Yeah.
The blank CDs you get from Radio Shack or wherever.
And
even with my employee discount, it was expensive.
You had to sit there and listen to it going,
What was the CD version of the Walkman? Was it the Walkman?
It was a Walkman CD player, yeah.
Okay.
I had a CD player that worked fine at first, and then after a while, you had to, like
hold it down
shut, yes, in order to
keep your finger on it.
Yeah.
When I was in law school, I took out a student loan and I bought a Sony, one of those stand up stereos, you know, with like the smoke glass.
Yeah. You took out a student loan.
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did that. I took out a student loan for that, a student loan to go to Europe, and a student loan for my wig.
Money well spent.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
I bet you got a lot out of that music system, though.
Not as much as I got out of that wig. Want to do a couple real fast throwbacks?
Yeah, we only have 1 minute left here, but I want to tell you about back in the day when it comes to June 19th. 45 years ago, it was 1981, and Superman 2 was released, starring Christopher Reeve, Gene Hackman, and Terrence Stamp as General Zod.
I loved it. It was good.
And 42 years ago, in 1984, the Chicago Bulls picked Michael Jordan from the University of North Carolina third in the NBA draft.
How about that? You know who went ahead of him?
No.
Sam Bowie, 7-foot center.
Yeah, I remember
who
Sam.
Who had a lot of injury problems, which is why he went number one, and then Clyde Drexler went number two.
Yeah.
And Clyde Drexler was really good.
Clyde the Glide.
That's a Hall of Famer. He's just not quite Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to The Dave Glover Show on KMOX. I'm Rachel Zimmerman. Thanks for hanging out with us on a Friday afternoon as we head into the weekend. You know, earlier this week, the James Beard Awards took place in Chicago, and several folks from St. Louis were nominated, which is a huge honor in and of itself. But everyone in the region is really happy this week because Chef Lauren Knowledge of Balkan Treat Box actually ended up winning the James Beard Award for Best Chef Midwest. I am so happy for Lauren. She makes incredible food. She makes it with a lot of love, and she is a really lovely person on top of it. Last year, I sat down with Lauren for an interview. She had been nominated for the James Beard Award last year, too, but we're so happy that she was able to take home the win this year. Let's listen in on my conversation with Chef Lauren Knowledge from Balkan Treat Box. Lauren, thank you for taking the time to come see me. This is really nice to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me.
And congratulations on being a James Beard finalist for Best Chef Midwest. Let's start by talking about, like, what does it mean to you to be a James Beard finalist?
Wow. That's a hard question to answer. I would say I feel like I'm living a dream at the moment, like, without that. What I've always wanted to do, I'm currently doing, and that is like super cool in and of itself. And this became a byproduct of, kind of living out the dream that I've had in my head for so long. And that is pretty cool to feel validated and to feel like I chose the right path and It's a huge honor, obviously. Came with a lot of luck and hard work. Everybody that's in our industry knows how tough it is. And, you know, things like this, you know, make it feel a little sweeter.
And that dream was having your own restaurant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why Balkan cuisine?
That has more to do with my husband. So he is from Bosnia, refugee of war in St. Louis. And obviously we met here. And, you know, when I say that this was a dream of mine, like I fully played restaurant as a child, would turn my entire home into a restaurant. I mean, more to get out of trouble, because I was quite a problem child. and that would make my parents happy. But, you know, it really was something that came naturally to me. And so therefore, you know, feeding people and nurturing them is something that I really enjoy. And obviously, like, Edo was at that point removed from his family, his immediate family, and, you know, missing his mom and missing his home and missing the things that come with your home. And a lot of that is food. And, you know, I think that was kind of a way that we could connect, was just talking about the food. And I had a little knowledge of the cuisine before we met. It just became really extensive from, you know, listening to what he wanted to eat to me trying to create it and, you know, failing miserably multiple times to really diving in and not only gaining family and a bunch of new, like a whole new skill set, but it just became part of my everyday. It became my whole world. And, you know, we would talk about it. We would cook it. I left the country for the first time to learn about and cook the food. And it was, yeah, it became a part of my life. And then once I fell in love with it, it became a mission of mine to, you know, learn as much as possible and highlight some things that I've found special and I know his family finds special. And we just continue to grow on that. And St. Louis has been really receptive to the cuisine, I think mostly out of the fact that, as we know, like Bosnians, you know, came here and there's a huge population of Bosnian people in St. Louis, the biggest outside of Bosnia. I think that's part of the reason why St. Louis kind of embraced us like a warm hug, because of curiosity.
So you mentioned falling in love with the cuisine. How important is it to fall in love with the food you're making?
I think it's everything. I think if you don't, you taste it, you know, like there's a feeling. I was talking to some guests yesterday at Telva, and they were Bosnian guests, and they were talking about how, you know, yes, they like the food, but, you know, one of the things that they really love about coming to our restaurants is the feeling that they get and that they feel, you know, represented and in a positive light, and that, you know, it's a whole feeling from start to finish. And I think that's really important. I think if you're not in love with the cuisine that you're doing, it could really inhibit your performance and what you're putting out and how people receive it.
Do you think you would have been able to like nail that feeling they were talking about without your trip to the Balkans?
Definitely
and that research?
Not. Yeah, no way. And Edo knew that. Like Edo's, I don't think people realize, but Edo really is a brain. He's super cerebral. And it was not something I was expecting to come out of his mouth when we started talking about this concept, food truck. And when he said it, I was really taken back. Mostly, like I said, because I hadn't left the country and we had kids, and it was not something that I thought was going to be, how do I say it? Just like I didn't think it would be possible to do that for many reasons. And, you know, he made me feel that it was possible. And then with the help of a lot of people and, you know, people cheering for us and rooting for us, like, we made it possible. And it changed my life.
It's really nice to find someone who makes you feel like things are possible like that.
There would be none of this without Edo. I mean, he really believed in me and believed that I was so much more than I thought I was. Mm-hmm. He had built me up enough to myself to have the confidence to do this and the confidence to keep going. And he taught me to love myself, you know, and he taught me to feel confident in what I'm doing. And he taught me to, I learned all of that from him, and I owe all of that to him. He's quite a remarkable person.
What's it like being in this with him? I think a lot of people would be intimidated by, like, working with their partner, living with their partner. What's it like for you guys?
You know, it's something we talk about and think about often. I think one of the coolest things is not just Edo and I, is when I met Edo, like I said earlier, like, he was estranged from his immediate family. And now we look around us and his dad is heading the oven with him. Mm-hmm. You know, they're baking bread together every day. And Emir is running Telva in the stadium. And we're all kind of like in and out and see each other every day. And yes, we're working, but there's just something really amazing about building something with people that are so, so, so proud. I feel like I'm just kind of like, just, I don't know, it's hard to explain. I feel like it's driven by them through me somehow. I don't know how to exactly explain that. It just feels like my role isn't as important as theirs. Just watching them, you know, interact with customers or, you know, feel it, everything feels purposeful. And it's, I often look around and watch them together and just feel a sense of accomplishment. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but it feels really good. And yeah, you know, I'm not sugarcoating the day-to-day, you know, grind and stress of restaurants and multiple restaurants and, you know, working with your partner. That's not easy. And but I feel like we've kind of, and both of our families. So my father was in business with his family and Edo's father was in business with family. And so we have kind of an understanding of what that looks like. And I think we do things a lot differently than our fathers did. And knock on wood, like, it seems to be going well so far. So I think it's a joy. Yeah, like, I really like it.
That's Chef Lauren Nalich from Balkan Treat Box. She just won the James Beard Award for Best Chef Midwest. We have a little more with her if you keep listening to The Dave Glover Show on KMOX. Welcome back. You're listening to The Dave Glover Show. I'm Rachel Zimmerman, replaying a interview I did with Chef Lauren Nalich of Balkan Treat Box last year. We're so happy for Lauren because she just took home the James Beard Award for Best Chef Midwest earlier this week. So cool. Here's the rest of my conversation with her. Why do you think we have such an amazing restaurant community in St. Louis? Because every chef I've had on the show says the same thing, and that's that everyone's willing to lift each other up, and there's not, like, a huge sense of, like, cutthroat competition. It's really about wanting to help each other.
Yeah, St. Louis is great for that. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, I mean, I like to say we're a little big city.
I say the same thing.
Yeah. But we are, you know, we all care about the culinary scene here in St. Louis. And if we're not picking each other up and helping one another, it doesn't succeed, which means none of us succeed. I think I've traveled now a lot through the states and abroad. And I would say the St. Louis culinary scene rivals a lot of big cities because we have to try harder because I'm going to see your face mm-hmm. in 2 months, in 3 months. Whereas in bigger cities that have a lot of tourism, we, you know, they're seeing people that are there for an hour, you know, that are there just to this, you know, stop in, or they're there for a day and they'll never see them again. We really have to work hard to gain customer loyalty. And I think that also we know the how hard that is. Mm-hmm. And it's just easier when you have people in your corner, you know, and it makes it easier on us to have that community and to have people to reach out to, because it's not easy, and it is a hard industry. A lot of things can go wrong. And since we all know that, you know, you don't want to see anybody fail because you work too hard.
How do you kind of shift into the mindset to execute this every day? Because I would assume there's a difference between like, oh, I'm going to cook for my family, I'm going to do this nice thing for them, but then now I'm in a restaurant setting and now I really have to deliver. Do you have anything where you're like, okay, this is kind of my mantra to get me going?
No, I don't need a lot to motivate, just because I feel really lucky that I get to do this. But what I will say is, you know, doing this for your family, I think I have a unique, opportunity because I'm doing this food for my husband's culture, you know, and for me on the daily, like watching people eat, and Edo gets very excited about sharing his food with, you know, American people. And I get very excited about sharing that food with people from that region and beyond. Because it's just like exciting to see how and if they relate to it, or if it makes them feel happy or evokes emotion. And that's motivating as hell. Like, just, it's still my favorite. My favorite viewpoint from Balkan is like being on the oven and looking out into the dining room and just watching people's reactions, you know, to what they're eating. And not just, you know, people from the Balkans, but all over. Like, we're not doing anything new, you know, this is like very old style cooking, you know, meat and vegetables over coals and grills and firing up a wood burning oven and making bread. I mean, this is a basic of all basics, but it invokes something.
I love that you're excited to share this food with like Bosnian people. He's excited to share with Americans. What an amazing balance.
I think it's part of the reason why it works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Congratulations once again to Chef Lauren Knowledge of Balkan Treat Box in Webster Groves. Could not be happier for her and the whole team there. And thanks for listening to The Dave Glover Show. I hope you have a really great weekend, and we will talk to you on Monday.